Hello guys, and welcome back to the Not So Fit Couple podcast with your hosts, Lucy Davis Fitz
and Benjamin Holden. So on today's episode of the podcast, we have a very special guest of us in Mr. Brad Schoenfeld, who is PhD, CSCS, CSPS, FNSCA, is an internationally renowned fitness expert and widely regarded as one of the leading authorities on body composition training. He is a lifetime drug-free bodybuilder, has won numerous natural bodybuilding titles. And to me, Brad Schoenfeld is the godfather, the Don Corleone of the fitness world. And what this man does not know about building muscle and hypertrophy is not worth knowing. His new book, Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy, second edition, is the most comprehensive resource on muscle hypertrophy in the world. And the two new chapters deliver practical content on the measurement of muscle hypertrophy and advanced training practices. And as a great admirer of Brad, me and Lucy bought his book in pre-release and have recommended it to a lot of our coaches and other clients. So without further ado, I will let Mr. Brad Schoenfeld fill in any gaps and tell you a little bit more about himself before we dive into the book and some of the questions that we've had today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Ben and Lucy. I'm happy to answer any questions.
As Ben said, we really appreciate having you on, and we're so excited because in today's podcast, we wanted to dispel some of the myths that have, I guess, arose due to social media. Now, when I first started lifting and getting into the gym, social media, I believe, was not as saturated with fitness content as it is now. And what I mean by this is there isn't a lot of regulation to the information being shared on social media, and a lot of the educational value has been lost along the way. So we are incredibly lucky to have Brad on today to dispel some of those myths around muscle building and fat loss. So like Ben said at the start, we have questions that are more so around muscle building, questions from myself and Ben, but also from you guys who have asked on social media.
Yeah. I just want to ask a question before we dive into the questions we've had from other people. Brad, is this you on the front of the book?
I'm not going to tell. It's a top secret.
I think if you would have led to that, you probably would have sold more copies of it if you just go over to you. But that's fine. So one of the first questions that we've had today, and it's probably one of the questions we get most often, and it's something that I've seen more and more of since home training and lockdown, and it is, what is a worthy metric for measuring the quality of a workout? Because we see so often now with the rise of social media coaches and influencers and their workouts with titles such as workout to make you sweat, this workout is going to make you sore, and people are being duped into believing that workouts should leave them in a pool of sweat or not being able to walk the next day. And then if they haven't, then they don't feel like they trained hard enough. So how do you feel? What's a good metric or a measurement for when training at home to make sure that you're progressing with your training?
Yeah, so what I can tell you is what is not a good metric, and that is being overly sore or sweating a lot. Those are not good metrics. As a matter of fact, being too sore would have a negative effect. So if you're finishing your workout and you could barely make it up the stairs or down the stairs, you've not had a good workout. You've actually taken your body generally past where it can properly repair itself in time for the next training session. You wouldn't feel... I mean, the soreness really would be the next day. So if the next day you're that sore, because delayed onset muscle soreness, the after workout you might be stiff, but that can not necessarily lead to delayed onset muscle soreness. So really, I think the better or the worst gauge would be if you're very sore the next day and then the next day, the next day, to the point where it's debilitating your workouts. That would be a negative indicator. I don't like to look at what an, because individual workouts can have specific purposes. So I think it's somewhat short-sighted to look at each workout as needing to have a certain metric to gauge it on quality, because you might have a workout that's a deload workout, or you can be doing auto-regulatory workouts where based on the days you're varying stimuli. So I think ultimately the metrics are what your progress is. It shouldn't be looked at on a workout-to-workout basis, but rather over specified periods of time, and that has to have enough time where you're going to see the adaptations. And that's going to thus give you a gauge as to whether what you're doing overall, the overall scheme of what you're doing is working.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. And I think with that as well, and this is, I think a lot of people do fall into the trap of, I'm so sore. I've obviously had a brilliant workout. And this was one of the questions we get asked frequently. And I think a lot of people get asked this question a lot. So kind of following on from that last question. So muscle damage is obviously one of the mechanisms of hypertrophy, but in terms of its actual importance to hypertrophy, could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So when we look at the mechanisms of hypertrophy, they're not well established at this point. I want to start off by saying that first. So we know that a degree of mechanical tension, you know, high levels of mechanical tension do fuel muscle growth. And that's basically the force that's placed on the muscle. And even that, how that is plays out, because we know that very light loads can produce high degrees of mechanical tension towards the last several repetitions. So that even in itself is somewhat of a nebulous concept. But other factors still need to be better understood. And metabolic stress is one. Muscle damage is another. One thing that is pretty clear is that too much muscle damage has a negative effect on growth. Whether a certain degree of muscle damage is required for growth remains still somewhat equivocal. Now, we do know that muscle damage by itself can produce muscle growth. That's been shown in multiple studies. The question is it additive to a resistance stress? So if you just damage a muscle, there's been studies that have shown that over time when the muscle remodels, it will grow from what it did. But that's in the context of no training whatsoever. We also know there are mechanisms related to the mechanism of damage that are involved in hypertrophy, such as muscle damage increases what are called satellite cells. And satellite cells basically are muscle stem cells that are required for long-term muscle growth, for continuing to grow. Again, the question, though, is whether it produces an additive effect to high degrees of mechanical tension. High degrees of mechanical tension by themselves will induce a satellite cell response. So these are all things that aren't well understood. I would hope over the next several years, we're learning a lot more as time's going on. Research is progressing, but I wrote a paper, which I know many of the listeners probably have read, called The Mechanisms of Muscle Hypertrophy and Their Application to Resistance Training, which was actually my master's project back in 2009. And it was published in Journal of Strength and Conditioning. And just looking back on what we know since I wrote that paper, I mean, over a decade ago now, there's been huge strides made. And I would say, even with all the strides we've made, we're still pretty much in the early stages of really understanding these factors. So I wish I can be more concrete in some of my answers to things like this, but I can only tell you what is shown through evidence. And like I said, what we do know is that high levels of muscle damage are a negative. It is possible that there is a sweet spot where some muscle damage at a certain level might have an additive effect. By the way, I'd also add, I'm not sure, now there's different ways of measuring muscle damage too, which I don't want to get into here. It's to get into the technicalities. This would be more of a research-based topic. But I will say that I'm not sure that you can actually have a high degree of mechanical tension without having some degree of muscle damage occurring. Yeah. You can have less or more, but I don't know how it can occur in the absence of some degree of structural perturbations to the tissue.
So just from our own experience, Brad, where do you think that this notion that muscle damage and being sore the next day, why do you think that's idolized a lot by the more modern era of the fitness industry? Because I know when I first started training in my early years, this was something of a trap that even I fell into. Yeah. And I remember doing some of the workouts, such as, like, I'm sure you know, the Tom Platt's leg workout, and they were kind of like mega volume workouts. For some days, I've done that workout before and literally couldn't walk for like 7 days, which obviously then impaired my training because I wasn't able to train for lower body for a long while. And obviously that kind of soreness and being run into the ground by a trainer is often idolized by both trainers and coaches who you will see in the gym. coaching clients. So where do you think that kind of idolization of muscular damage and DOMS comes from?
I can speculate just knowing from people that I've worked with, but usually, number one, people are perceptual beings. So this is a perceptual response. They can actually feel the soreness. And there's this thought that, hey, if I have, if I'm feeling it, it must be doing something to my muscles. Mm-hmm. That this breakdown must be causing them. That if you're not feeling this, and vice versa, if you don't feel anything, it's like, well, if I'm not feeling anything, then maybe I didn't do anything to the muscles to make them want to grow. So look, there is a somewhat of a valid response that the body does respond to stimuli and tries to get stronger from when it is broken down. I mean, it kind of goes along with the gas response by Selye, general adaptation syndrome, where you have an initial negative effect that is then seen by supercompensation. And that's seen like with a, let's say you get the flu, you get a counteractive response, which is an immune response, which makes you more resistant to the flu. So you get better because of the negative response. So again, it's hard to know. Different people are going to have different thoughts on it. But I think the primary thing is just the perceptual. When you feel it, feel something happening in your muscles, you think something's working. Yeah. And that is not necessarily, logic does not necessarily translate into practice, as we know.
Yeah. So I suppose that whole notion of kind of almost to a certain degree, seeing is believing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if we go into kind of another theory, which we had another question for you, Brad, as well, from some of the guys on social media. And I think this is another one which has arisen since, especially with home training. And from what we have seen is the use of the term high intensity workout, which I believe is being used sort of in the wrong context by some people. And they're using it in comparison to high intensity interval training. So in the sense of hypertrophy, can you just put into context for us what is meant by high intensity?
You'd have to tell me. To different people, that would have different meanings. So there is like the Mike Mentzer, who maybe some of your listeners might not know, was a very popular professional bodybuilder. And he actually called it heavy duty, but that was based upon the work of Arthur Jones before him, who developed this one set to failure approach, which he called high intensity training. And then Mike Mentzer picked up on it and popularized it, I think, to probably a greater extent than even Jones did. That's one form. Intensity by itself can just mean training to failure. So you'd have to define for me what you mean or what you think the people mean by high intensity training. Me to answer that.
So I think with what's seen on social media, when people say high intensity interval training is like a HIIT class.
So like, so you're talking high intensity, because I thought Bennett said not high intensity.
Yeah, what we're saying is people seem to be mixing up the difference between high intensity training and then high intensity interval training. So the context in which they're using it on social media is very different. And I think people are getting confused between
High intensity interval training has a very specific meaning, and that is universal, in that it is using basically bouts of endurance type aerobic exercise, which are taking you above your lactate threshold, generally well above your lactate threshold, and then having other intervals interspersed with intervals where you're well below your lactate threshold. And that can be the classic example would be a bout of sprinting and then or running very fast, and then followed by a period of walking. So you do, let's say, a minute walking, then a minute running very fast, then a minute walking. That's kind of your classic high-intensity interval training. And there's variations on it. There's SIT, which is sprint interval training, and that would be sure you can't sprint generally for a minute, so the sprint would be a less time. But anyway, that follows that pattern. With high-intensity resistance training, it takes on a different context. So again, you'd have to qualify for me what the people are referring to in that context.
Yeah, so that's, I think you answered it yourself. People think just by using the word high intensity that is a HIIT class, that is doing sprints and it's doing a circuit when it's not, because people label their workouts as high intensity and they've filmed a HIIT class, and it's just dispelling that myth that high intensity does not mean solely mean HIIT training.
And what I would say certainly is that high intensity interval training is not going to be ideal for muscle building. I mean, you might gain, especially if you're a beginner, you might gain a little muscle. And it's primarily, at least from some of the studies, more in the type 1 fibers. But it's more, basically, high intensity interval training follows aerobic training benefits for the most part. You're going to be getting increases in mitochondria, aerobic enzymes, cardiovascular VO2 max, other cardiovascular and cardiorespiratory benefits, and much less so on muscle and strength building. You're going to get some, particularly if you're a beginner, but especially as you get more experience, that's not building substantial muscle.
Yeah, I think you referenced something about this on a slightly similar topic in the book in regards to the effects of, some of the effects of aerobic exercise on muscular damage in comparison to resistance training. And it's to do, I think, with the build-up over the next couple of days afterwards, to do with muscular damage and to do with, was it creatine kinase release? Yeah, so I think you drawed on some of the factors with that in regards to the effects of those and the different types of exercise on muscular damage as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so the damage actually follows different time courses experienced in, let's say, downhill running versus with aerobic training, usually doing downhill running to get the eccentric effect for muscle damage. But you can get it if you're overdoing it. So anyway, bottom line is the time courses are different. The effects of the muscle damage actually display in different ways.
Another question. I think this is probably more prevalent in the UK because we still don't have gyms. Mm-hmm. We have no access to any gyms.
You don't have it in New York either at this time. So depends on where you are in the US. Yeah, a lot of places in the US still do not have access to gyms.
Oh, so this question will apply to there as well. So what, and this is a question we have had continuously, and I assume a lot of people
have. I think it's quite general as well.
It's very general. But what would be your advice to someone who is at home at the moment with very limited kit and they're trying to retain some muscle tissue?
Well, first of all, retaining muscle is much easier than building it. So you can get by to retain muscle doing much less, both in volume, loading, et cetera, than building strength and muscle. What I would say is that if you carry out exercise with a high level of effort, you can do it with very little equipment and still certainly maintain, if not gain, depending upon if you're a high level bodybuilder, it's going to be pretty difficult to gain, and you might even lose a little. So part of it will depend upon where you're at. But for the vast majority of people, they're not pro bodybuilders or anywhere close. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've done so much research showing that very light loads, up to like 40 plus reps, can build just as much muscle as a hypertrophy range, a 10 rep area, as long as you're taking it close to failure. So as long as you're pushing really hard. I mean, doing things like a single leg squat, you could do a body weight single leg rear foot elevated squat. You put your foot up on a chair or a bench at your home, sofa even, depends on what you have. I mean, you pump out 20, 25, 30 reps with that, and you can get a really good burn on that. I mean, you can get very good results. I mean, push-ups, and you could do things by a weighted vest. There are things you could do with very little space requirement. A weighted vest takes up basically zero space in your house. You could also buy it like I did. So I actually, when this whole COVID thing happened, I luckily got in early because they ended up selling out. But I bought a pair of adjustable dumbbells. So I have adjustable dumbbells. I got a bench. I got resistance bands. So I have equipment that's very portable, takes up really very little space in the house. And, I do some higher reps with certain things, but I'm able to get a very good workout. I got a chin-up bar. So again, you don't need a lot of equipment, certainly, to maintain muscle. The real key is to training with a high level of effort. So coming at least pretty close to training to muscle failure, with an RIR, repetitions in reserve of, a couple reps short, especially as you're getting in your higher rep ranges.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that we've been doing with people and with different clients in regards to helping to try and progressively overload some of the training at home is, especially with a lot of people generally working with resistance bands, is just looking at more so time under tension. So for example, with some people who may be doing, instead of doing like 3-4 sets of 12 reps, who look at kind of like 3-4 sets of doing 60 seconds under load, and then the week after doing like 70 seconds under load, and the week after doing like 80 seconds under load, and then increasing the set. So just progressively overloading using different variables instead of just looking at rep ranges. So again, more so using time with attention to progressively overload with such limited kit to
use. Yeah, and you could slow down the repetition. So instead of doing, let's say, a 1 second up, 2 seconds down, you could do 3 seconds up, 3 seconds down. You don't want to go too slow, but there is some evidence that really slowing it down to very slow levels, you know, 8-10 seconds per concentric, eccentric, can potentially have some negative effects. But certainly in your anything 3-3-3, 4-4 even, makes the reps harder to do. And again, it's whether it's time or reps, I think it's more less relevant than making sure those last several reps, however you're going to go about, you know, carrying it out, whether you're doing it based on time or reps, just making sure your last couple of reps are close to failure, that you're exerting yourself with a high level of effort. Because that, look, ultimately, that's how the body responds. If you're not challenging your muscles beyond their present capacity, they're not going to respond. So if you're using very light weights and you've left 10 reps in the tank, well, basically the body has no reason to not only to hypertrophy, but has no reason to even stay at the same level, because now it's perceiving that you don't need the same level of effort that you used to need. So basically it's just showing your body, for making your body understand that it needs a high level of effort. And what does that translate into? Increased strength, increased muscle. When the body knows that it is going to be challenged, it is going to respond in ways that are going to be beneficial to its ability to handle that challenge. And in this case, it is more muscle, more strength, potentially more muscle endurance, et cetera.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Brad. And then if I had another question, I think you've kind of touched on this already in regards to the elements of hypertrophy. So to do with the three elements, and just for our listeners who are lifting and looking into hypertrophy a lot more, the three elements obviously include muscular damage,
mechanical tension, and metabolic stress.
Yeah, so one of the questions that we've had about the three components is, if we had to prioritize one in regard to building muscle tissue.
I don't like answering those questions. Why would you ever have to do that? So to me, it's a silly hypothetical. Just like if someone says, what would be your best exercise if you can only do one exercise? Like, why would you don't have to do that. So why would you pose the question? It's answering a question that really doesn't provide utility, in my opinion. So obviously, as I mentioned earlier, mechanical tension is the primary driver. Without mechanical tension, you can increase metabolic stress, let's say through a blood pressure cuff on someone without doing any, you're not going to get the same degree of hypertrophy if you combine it with mechanical tension. The question with the mechanisms is, are they additive to one another? So if you're saying what is the most important factor, it is mechanical tension. There's no question to it. But I don't see how it's relevant to ask questions like if you needed to do one, because you don't. It's just if the goal is to maximize hypertrophy, you want to look at all your factors and then find out what is the best mix of doing that. And by the way, I don't necessarily even try to look at the mechanisms are good for understanding, in my humble opinion, for understanding what drives hypertrophy and how to, in general, structure routines. But I think we want to look at things like the variables themselves and what we know through research. The mechanisms kind of take care of themselves. So, I mean, if you're going to do, let's say, higher reps, if that's something that's beneficial to combine higher reps with lower reps, well, the higher reps will have high levels of metabolic stress and the lower repetitions don't. So if you're just looking at it from a variable standpoint, look at high reps, low reps, and look at the research on that, and the metabolic stress and mechanical tension are, like I said, they are taking that for granted within the into account. Taking that into account based on the variables that you're looking at.
So a question we have here, and this is a very broad question, it's also one that I'm very interested with, because I've come from a background where I've managed to keep a lower body fat percentage and build muscle. And a lot of the time people question genetics. Now, and I know you mentioned this in your book as well, but just the broad question, do genetics influence the ability for somebody to grow muscle?
Absolutely. Genetics, you don't need research studies to show you that. I mean, there's people that they pop out of the womb and they look like they've never lifted a weight and they look like they've been training for 10 years. By the way, when I do seminars, I have a picture of Dorian Yates at, I think he was training for like 3 months at the time. I mean, the dude was, certainly it was before his pharmaceutical experimentations. He was like 18 years old. But you look at him, he looks like he'd been training for 10 years, you know, or at that age. And there's other people, they've trained a long time, and they don't barely look like they lift. Now, part of that, of course, is going to be, I just made a post today, interestingly, about genetics and their relevance on Instagram. But genetics always are going to matter. What I would say is that there is no one who cannot build appreciable muscle. Some people, just based upon who your parents were, is going to be the difference whether you might be a Mr. Olympia candidate or not, or a natural bodybuilding champion, mm-hmm. if you want to go that route. So if you did not pick the right parents, if you do not have good genetics, you're never going to be a bodybuilding champion. It's just as simple as that. That doesn't mean you can't build a good physique and have big muscles or bigger muscles, certainly. But there's always going to be a genetic component. And they've tried to quantify it through research, and it seems somewhere around 50% of your results or so are based upon who your parents are.
Yeah.
I think I'm just based on what you were saying about Dorian Yates. I think there was a similar YouTube interview, I think it was with Eddie Hall, and to do with his genetics. And I can't remember what the exact gene is called now, because I think you've referenced it somewhere in your book, but people call it the Hercules gene. I think, is it something to do with the deficiency in, is it...
balls. Is it balls?
No, the gene. Is it
there's a myostatin gene. Very few people have a double knockout. So myostatin limits the amount of growth that you can get. Very few people have a double knockout, but the ones that do have both myostatin genes, as would be one from each parent, knocked out, are hugely muscled. And there are cows, they're called the Schwarzenegger cows, the Belgian blue cows, have that in my book as well. And you look at them and it's just like a ripped cow. But I mean, that there's multiple genes. There's an angiotensin converting enzyme gene, so it's called the ACE gene. Anyway, there's several actin, there's another gene, ACTN gene. So there are certain genes that have been at least thought to be involved. And that again is a topic for future research.
Yeah, I know I'm not, there's an interview with Eddie Hall and he's talking about, I think he's had some research done in regards to genes or a bit of a diagnostic done, and it was believed to have some kind of deficiency in it, or which allowed him to grow more than usual. So it was kind of like the gods sort of aligned when they were mixing Eddie Hall up. And unfortunately, he kind of got into lifting.
There was a rumor that Flex Wheeler, who was a popular bodybuilding champion in the 90s and early 2000s, had a null myostatin gene mutation. So who knows?
So just onto the next question then, Brad, and this is to do with most to do with nutrition. And we know there are different ways or different amounts that the body can absorb a protein. But this is a question, again, that we get often over and over again. But how much can we consume at one time, or how much can the body utilize at one time in regards to the amount of protein that we take in and digest?
How much protein can the body absorb is virtually unlimited. So the absorption just means that it gets into the bloodstream for the most part. And there can be, depending upon if you're taking single amino acids, sometimes you can have malabsorption of certain single amino acids if they're overwhelmed by others. But the body can absorb almost an unlimited amount. How much can it use is still somewhat of a equivocal question. I collaborated on a paper with a colleague of mine, Alan Aragon, not too long ago, which was published in the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. We discussed this topic. There's going to be factors that need to be accounted for. So are you taking in the protein as just a single, like a whey protein? So if you're drinking, which many of the studies on the topic have done, that's going to have a different impact, because it can be whey protein, first of all, is very quickly absorbed into the system and thus undergoes more rapid oxidation. of the amino acids. Whereas if you're taking in, let's say, whole foods, let's say a steak with potatoes and broccoli, let's say, vegetables, you're going to have a slower time release of the amino acids. So it's going to be really equivocal. I would say that ideally what we pegged was somewhere between 0.4 to 0.5 or so grams per kilogram per meal. But even that, I would say, is still somewhat equivocal. Look, if you look at some of the more recent data on intermittent fasting, it doesn't seem to show much of a negative effect. And obviously, the people doing intermittent fasting need to get in a lot more protein in single meals. So what I'd say is that ideally, my general recommendation is somewhere around 0.4 to 0.5 grams per kilogram per meal, spread out over four or so meals a day. If you're going to have four meals, that would seem to be kind of your ideal for maximizing muscle protein synthesis.
Yeah, I think that's where probably the debate comes up with it, is because both me and Lucy do intermittent fasting. So I think that's why one of the questions has arisen in regards to the amount of protein. So for example, if we're intermittent fasting and we sometimes have less frequent meals, but larger amounts of more calorie dense meals, then is there kind of an optimal amount with that? But I guess for a lot of people, especially for our listeners who aren't professional bodybuilders or who aren't looking to compete, are often more looking at the suboptimal lifestyle rather than trying to optimize every single part of their diet and training, I suppose.
I think what's interesting as well, though, because I get asked this a lot. I've always had a very high protein diet, and I'm talking 160 grams of protein a day, and it's never ever had an adverse effect on me. And I know there are some research papers that suggest the risk of high protein diets, and I've personally never found this. So I've always said to people, I've never had an adverse effect of high protein diets. But what's your view on someone like myself who's 143 pounds having such a high protein diet? Is it a negative thing, or I'm curious.
Yeah, there's no research, and certainly that I'm aware of, in healthy people, and I've looked at all the research that would show that a healthy individual is at a negative health risk with high protein diets. And that's been shown up to very high protein consumption, somewhere around 4 grams per kilogram, 3.5, 4 grams per kilogram over fairly long periods. Over, I think it was a year this study ran or so. So, and that goes for kidney, bone, really any health marker. Where it can be a negative and potential negative, at least based on what we see from the current research, is in those with kidney issues. So if you have a kidney issue, then having a higher protein diet may be negative, certainly very high. It's not clear as to what your ideal. There's been some conflicting evidence that I've seen on what actually
obviously
you should be taking, but certainly very high protein
diets
would be contraindicated.
To do with satiety as well, and regards to appetite. So I often find it, my appetite isn't as high when I'm on a higher protein diet for that reason as well.
Yeah, definitely. A question, I think this is probably the most common question any coach would ever be asked, and we just want to know your view on it. And it is basically, what is your view on this whole idea of building muscle and losing fat at the same time?
Yeah, so first of all, I see that a lot in my own studies, as well as many of my colleagues. It's been well documented. Body recomposition can happen. There's three basic factors involved. A, number one, how much weight do you have to lose? So the more weight you have, the more weight you have to lose, the greater your ability to have body recomposition. Number two, what is your training age, training status? So if you've been training if you're a newbie, you're going to have a much easier time having a recomposition, losing fat while gaining muscle. If you've been training 10 years, much more difficult. And by the way, combined, if you're lean and you've been training a long time, it becomes even more hard. And the white elephant in the room, of course, also is anabolic steroid use, or pharmacological enhancement, if you will. It doesn't have to be steroids, but other pharmacological aids. And even with people who are lean and been training a long time, if you're taking anabolic agents, you can undergo body recomposition, transformation. But other than that, it starts becoming, so can you do it otherwise? Yeah, actually, I just was involved in a case study of a natural bodybuilder. And in the early, he was started out very lean. He was, I think, started 11% body fat. I've been training for 8-10 years. And the first couple of months, he was just starting his diet. He was losing body fat and actually gaining a little bit of muscle. And then all of a sudden it fell off the cliff. And as he started getting into his competition diet, he just started losing, you know, substantial amounts of fat-free mass along with his...
One of the other questions I think will be fitting for both listeners in the UK and I suppose for any of the guys who are in New York as well, just with gyms being closed. And one of the questions that we've had a lot recently is regards to the gyms reopening, because for us in the UK, it's looking like it's going to be around August time. And yeah, which is great. And the question is, what would be your key pointers to people in regards to when we first go back to the gym, in regards to training volume and balancing recovery? Because I think what a lot of people will probably do is jump in the deep end, go back to the old regime or routine that they're probably sticking to. And then, especially when it comes to DOMS and muscular soreness, are going to be sore for days after. So it becomes a balancing act between the training volume and the recovery time and how you're able to get back in and start training again. So just what would your advice be with that, so to speak, Brad?
So first of all, it's going to somewhat depend, of course, on what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. So if you just have been doing nothing, then you got a real... So I'll give it this way. If you haven't been doing anything, let's say you just took the 3 months, whatever, 4 or 5 months off, start off very slow. You should start off with roughly 50% volume, have an RIR, repetitions in reserve, of more than three or more, so you're stopping well short of failure. The load should be relatively lighter as well in that regard. And do that for a week. Then the next week, go up to 75%, where your RIR can then start approaching 2 to 3. And then by the third week, you should be back to where you can be. If you've been training, then it's going to somewhat depend upon what you've, you know, what have you been training on. Just the fact that you're going to use different equipment. So the changes in equipment itself tends to bring about muscle damage. Changing exercises will cause greater muscle damage. So doing muscle damage has to do with novel stimuli. So if you're doing something you haven't been doing before, then that's going to be, that can set you back. So what I'd say is that still go into it somewhat easier. The volume should be somewhat lower, but again, it's going to depend really on what you've been doing and basically the differences between what you've been doing to what you're going to do. And if the greater the differences, the more you're going to have to be cautious in that regard.
Mm-hmm. I know, listened to, I think it was Jeff Nippard who spoke about this on a recent video, and he was talking about doing it in phases as well, kind of similar to what you've been talking about there, Brad. And he was talking also about the type of exercise that we're doing. So in regards to, he was talking that kind of 2 week first phase of maybe for some people, depending on how much training they've been doing at home, doing sort of isolation style exercise only, and then leaving maybe some of the compound lifts and lifting heavy loads in kind of that second phase of maybe week 3 to week 4.
Yeah, certainly that's a good option. I think Jeff is a really astute fitness pro. And look, there's not one way to go about it. So yeah, you could focus more on single joint exercises, of course, then you're going to have to then go to your multi-joints. So if you haven't been doing anything, then I think that that might be a more beneficial strategy. If you've been training at home, at some point you're going back to your multi-joints and they're going to be a novel stimulus and you're still going to have to approach that with caution. Yeah. So yeah, there's never one answer to applied questions. When you're asking questions like these types of applied questions, I'd always say it depends, and there's always multiple strategies that can be pursued.
Yeah, I think with that, one of the things that I was going to mention was this kind of period. So for example, people haven't been training for 3 or 4 months, and I suppose what it's commonly known as with like the bro terms would be like newbie gains. Do you think there's going to be this period of where people go back to the gym of where they're going to be really kind of hyper responsive to adaptation?
Yeah, and certainly that can happen. Now, what I'd say is that generally that's just bringing you back to your former baseline. But there is some evidence that perhaps desensitizing muscle can actually have a greater effect. That's not clear. I certainly don't think taking 3 months off is a great strategy for that, but shorter periods of desensitization, that's where you're kind of deloading or even active recovery might come in.
Brad, that was the last question that we had for you anyway. So it's been an absolute pleasure to obviously have you on today. In regards to the new book, if people want to grab this, where is the best place to grab it from?
Amazon.com is generally the best place. I know the UK, it's not somehow not in stock. But you can also go to my publisher, which is Human Kinetics. So if you go to the Human Kinetics website, it also is available in PDF format from Human Kinetics. On Amazon, it's just in hardcover and in Kindle. But if you want PDF, you can get it from my publisher. So yeah, it's a very sciencey book, I would say. So it's not a light reading training book. It has training, certainly a lot of applied aspects, but it's for people who really want to understand the science of muscle growth.
Yeah, I think even more so for me and Lucy, when we've been going through the newest edition, it's even for us like one of those books that it's not like a normal read that you have to take a lot more time kind of digesting the content. And we find it best to have a separate notebook with it and just take our own notes from the book as well and some of the key pointers. And I think that for us has been one of the best ways that we've learned from it. And also, Brad, just in case people want to catch you on socials or anywhere else, where's the best place that they can find you?
Yeah, I would just say Google me, but I'm on Twitter and Instagram are the two main ones. I'm also on Facebook, and you just search my name, you'll find me.
Brilliant. And thanks for all those listeners who have tuned in today.
Yeah, a massive, massive thank you to everyone who has listened. Make sure you tag us all on the podcast so we know that you've enjoyed it. And as always, if you can pop us a vote on the British Podcast Awards, that would be greatly appreciated. And a massive, massive thank you again, Brad. This podcast has been extremely valuable and we're so lucky to have had you on.
My pleasure, guys.